I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Hi, I'm Madigan, and you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, a podcast that explores the world through a personal feminist perspective. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another week of Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. I'm not giving you an entirely new episode this week. Instead, I am going to be giving you a Patreon-exclusive episode, and I had previously shared about 5 minutes of this episode at the end of a mini that I did a little while ago, but I need a little bit more time to research the new episode that I'm working on, so I figured that this would be a great thing to release in the meantime, so I hope that you all really enjoy. But also, I wanted to give you all a little bit of a scheduling update with Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. With the state of the world being what it is, and for things being very, very polarizing at the moment, I have decided that instead of doing a once a week mini news episode, I am going to take one of my full length episodes that I would normally do in the month and make it a full length news episode. This way, I can really take my time to pick the topics that I think are going to be most appropriate, take more time to do some research, and honestly, releasing the news episodes and posting anything political on social media has been a really huge stress inducer for me lately, and it's been really polarizing to even get some of the podcast work done because I've just started getting a lot of anxiety around it. And so I had a lovely chat with Crystal from Realm Network, and she was so lovely and understanding in that I felt like I needed to at least adapt how I did these mini episodes for now. So hopefully all of you are okay with this. You're still going to be getting your news from me, but it's just not going to be as frequent. And also, hopefully this will also give me more time to be able to do things on Patreon. I'm also working on starting a new series right now. I'm editing, I'm producing, and today I made teacups into candles for India's baby shower next weekend. But as always, I really want to do my best to be able to dedicate as much time as I possibly can to this show. And with there being a lot of anxiety around the show for me the last couple of months, it's been harder for me to do that. It's just been harder for me to mentally get over that block. but I feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders, and I think that this is going to be a really great transition for me. I'm not sure if I'm going to keep it permanently like this in the schedule. I have a feeling that when we get closer to election time, I might want to start doing weekly news episodes again, but just stay tuned. I'm going to keep you all in the loop of what I'm planning on doing. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode covering Rachel Corrie.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
A couple of weeks ago for the mini episode, I covered the self-immolation death of Aaron Bushnell. And in doing so, I also learned of another activist from the United States named Rachel Corrie, who lost her life back in 2003 when she went to Gaza with a charity that she had joined. And that was another really huge story internationally at the time. And what Rachel Corrie went through and the things that she was fighting for and against in Gaza very much resonates today. So I thought I would share with you what I've learned about Rachel Corrie. In March 2003, Rachel Corrie, a student at the Evergreen State College in Washington and an activist, was killed while in Rafah, Gaza, where she joined other International Solidarity Movement, ISM, activists in efforts to prevent Israel's demolition of Palestinian property. Rachel was born on April 10, 1979, in Olympia, Washington. She was the youngest of three children to Craig and Cindy Corrie. The Corries kind of remind me of my family, minus the siblings, as I'm an only child. My parents were white, raised Catholic, and became middle class once my dad started making good ad money, but both of them had always leaned very liberal. And Rachel's whole family is like white, blonde hair, blue eyed, quote unquote, all American, even though I fucking hate that term. I think it is so racist. But that is, I think, what a lot of publications at the time described Rachel as. And Rachel herself described her family as, quote, average Americans, politically liberal, economically conservative, middle class. When Rachel was 10 years old, she spoke at the fifth grade conference on world hunger, saying, quote, "I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us and we are ignoring them. We have to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have to understand that they dream our dreams and we dream theirs. We have to understand that they are us, we are them. My dream is to stop hunger by the year 2000. My dream is to give the poor a chance. My dream is to save the 40,000 people who die each day. My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. If we ignore hunger, that light will go out. If we all help and work together, it will grow and burn free with the potential of tomorrow." Holy shit, she was 10 years old when she wrote that. That is so unbelievably well thought out and so beautiful, so fucking smart. Oh my God. I take care of kids. I don't know if I've ever heard of a 10-year-old be quite so eloquent, although T was a thinker. He, never mind, maybe T would have done something not quite so well written, but the thought behind it maybe would have been there. After graduating from Capital High School, she went to Evergreen State College, which was in her hometown of Olympia, Washington. After a year there, she decided to take a year off and work as a volunteer for the Washington State Conservation Corps. With the group, she spent the next 3 years making weekly visits to patients in mental health facilities. When she got back to Evergreen State College, she became known as a committed peace activist, arranging events through a local group called Olympians for Peace and Solidarity. She later joined the International Solidarity Movement Organization, ISM, which protests against the policies of the Israeli army in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. As a senior in college, she proposed an independent study program in which she could travel to Gaza, join the ISM team, and initiate a sister city project between Olympia and Rafah. Before leaving the States, she also organized a pen pal program for children in Olympia and Rafah. Such a great idea. I loved pen pal programs when I was growing up. It was so much fun. I remember that we did a pen pal situation with a bunch of people in nursing homes at one point, and that was super fun. Oh, so sweet. Rachel Corey left behind many, many diary entries and emails that she sent her loved ones. And in one such diary entry from January 2003, now entitled Leaving Olympia, Rachel wrote, "We are all born and someday we'll all die, most likely to some degree alone. What if our aloneness isn't a tragedy? What if our aloneness is what allows us to speak the truth without being afraid? What if our aloneness is what allows us to adventure, to experience the world as a dynamic presence, as a changeable, interactive thing?" Oh, it's just like, it seems so eerie knowing that her life will end before she's able to return to the States and see her family again. And she was virtually alone when she died. But I'm not quite there yet. While in Rafah, Rachel was part of about 8 activists from outside of Palestine who would stand in front of bulldozers in attempt to stop the home demolitions that were being carried out by the Israeli military. Israeli authorities claimed that these demolitions were because, quote, "Palestinian gunmen used the structures as covers to shoot at troops patrolling the area or to conceal arms smuggling tunnels under the Gaza-Egypt border." Sound familiar? To me, it sounds a lot like the Israeli military saying that, oh, Gaza is hiding in the hospitals and all of these places where there are vulnerable Palestinians, so why don't we shoot up those places? And Rachel didn't ease into her time there in Rafah. On her first night, she and 2 other ISM members set themselves up directly between the Palestinians and the Israeli snipers manning watchtowers beside Block J, which has been described as a densely populated neighborhood and frequent target of gunfire from an Israeli watchtower. By situating themselves where they did, they were hoping to discourage shooting. They showed banners indicating that they were quote-unquote internationals, hoping that that would protect them. But when the Israeli soldiers began firing warning shots, Rachel and her group took down their tent and abandoned the area. What a first night. An interpreter who worked with the ISM at the time described them as, quote, not only brave, but crazy. Palestinian militants were concerned that the internationals would get caught in crossfire, while the residents in the area worried that they might be spies. To ease their suspicion of her, Rachel learned a few words of Arabic and participated in a mock trial where she denounced the, quote, crimes of the Bush administration. I would have been right there with you, girl. In the last month of her life, Rachel spent a lot of her time helping protect municipal workers in Rafah who were trying to repair damage to the Canada Well, as it was called by Israeli soldiers. The well was built in 1999 and supplied more than 50% of Rafah's water before it was damaged. The city was now under strict rationing policies, with only a few hours of running water available on alternate days. Israeli snipers would often shoot at civilian workers who tried to repair these wells, and ISM wanted to repel them. In one of Rachel's diary entries, she wrote, quote, activists and workers were fired upon several times over a period of about 1 hour. One of the bullets came within 2 meters of three internationals and a municipal water worker close enough to spray bits of debris in their faces as it landed at their feet. On February 15, 2003, Rachel took part in the anti-war protest in Gaza against the invasion of Iraq. There, she was photographed burning a makeshift U.S. flag, which is quite the image to a lot of Americans at the time. I don't know how many listeners are around my age, but if you are Gen Z, you will not remember this. But it was not popular to be against the war in Iraq or the war on terror when it first started. People were really, really behind President Bush, and Bush and the administration and the Republicans would really go out of their way to try to blackball people who would come forward with statements against the Bush administration, against the war. The Chicks made a comment about Bush during one of their concerts, which like almost ended their career at one point. It's wild. So that's the world that we're living in at this time. It was very, very unpopular to be anti-war. And I think just as it would be today, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to get super pissed off about you burning an American flag. But wearing it all over your body and waving it from your car and all the other ways that Americans use American flags to decorate is totally fine. But burning it, goddess forbid. Anyway, after her death, Rachel's parents released this statement about the photo. Quote, the act, while we may disagree with it, must be put into context. Rachel was partaking in a demonstration in Gaza opposing the war on Iraq. She was working with children who drew two pictures, one of the American flag and one of the Israeli flag, for burning. Rachel said that she could not bring herself to burn the picture of the Israeli flag with the Star of David on it, but under such circumstances, in protest over a drive toward war and her government's foreign policy that was responsible for much of the devastation that she was witness to in Gaza, she felt it okay to burn the picture of her own flag. We have seen photographs of memorials held in Gaza after Rachel's death in which Palestinian children and adults honor our daughter by carrying a mock coffin draped with the American flag. We have been told that our flag has never been treated so respectfully in Gaza in recent years. We believe Rachel brought a different face of the United States to the Palestinian people, a face of compassion. It is the image of Rachel with the American flag that we hope will be remembered most. Oh, I really love her parents, FYI. Okay, and here is the day that would become Rachel's last. On March 16th, 2003, the IDF was acting out an operation of demolition of Palestinian homes in Rafah, and Rachel, with a group of 3 British and 4 American ISM activists, attempted to disrupt them. Rachel placed herself in the path of a Caterpillar D9R armored bulldozer. This thing is huge, and it's specifically modified by the Israeli army. As she stood in its way, she was then run over by the bulldozer and fatally injured. Other ISM activists had to alert the operator of the bulldozer of what had happened so she could be removed from underneath. They took her to the Palestinian Najjar Hospital, getting her there about 5:05 p.m., still alive but in very critical condition. At 5:20, she was declared dead. ISM activist Richard Purcell, who was there with Rachel on that day, gave his account of the event, stating, quote, "They began demolishing one house. We gathered around and called out to them and went into the house, so they backed out. During the entire time, they knew who we were and what we were doing because they didn't shoot at us. We stood in their way and shouted. There were about 8 of us in an area of about 70 square meters. Suddenly, we saw they turned to a house they had started to demolish before, and I saw Rachel standing in the way of the front of the bulldozer. There's no way he didn't see her, since she was practically looking into the cabin. At one stage, he turned around toward the building. The bulldozer kept moving, and she slipped and fell off the plow. But the bulldozer kept moving, the shovel above her. I guess it was about 10 or 15 meters that it dragged her and for some reason didn't stop. We shouted like crazy to the operator through loudspeakers that he should stop, but he just kept going and didn't lift the shovel. Then it stopped and backed up. We ran to Rachel. She was still breathing." To this day, there are disputes as to whether the bulldozer operator saw Rachel or not, and if her injuries were caused by being crushed under the blade or by the mound of debris the bulldozer was pushing. On the one side, they said that the operator couldn't have seen or heard Rachel as she was behind a mound of earth. But this doesn't seem to align with the fact that the whole point of what ISM was doing was to get in the path visibly in order to get them to stop. I doubt she was purposefully hiding behind some sort of mound. An IDF spokesperson has admitted that the Caterpillar D9 bulldozers have a restricted field of vision with several blind spots. Eyewitness and ISM member Tom Dale commented on this, saying, quote, "Whatever one thinks about the visibility from a D9 bulldozer, it is inconceivable that at some point the driver did not see her, given the distance from which he approached, while she stood unmoving in front of it. As I told the court, we'll get there. Just before she was crushed, Rachel briefly stood up on top of the rolling mound of earth, which had gathered in front of the bulldozer. Her head was above the level of the blade and just a few meters from the driver." An American ISM witness, Joe Carr, who went under the assumed name of John Smith during his time in Gaza, had the following account when written in an affidavit published by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Quote, "Still wearing her fluorescent jacket, she knelt down at least 15 meters in front of the bulldozer and began waving her arms and shouting, just as activists had successfully done dozens of times that day. When it got so close that it was moving the earth beneath her, she climbed onto the pile of rubble being pushed by the bulldozer. Her head and upper torso were above the bulldozer's blade, and the bulldozer operator and co-operator could clearly see her. Despite this, the operator continued forward, which caused her to fall back, out of view of the driver. He continued forward and she tried to scoot back, but was quickly pulled underneath the bulldozer. We ran toward him and waved our arms and shouted, one activist with the megaphone, but the bulldozer operator continued forward until Corey was all the way underneath the central section of the bulldozer." He said that Rachel had sat down in front of the bulldozer and the operator scooped her up with a pile of earth, dumped her on the ground, and ran over her twice. However, he did later acknowledge that Rachel could have fallen into the dirt pile, making it so that the operator could have lost sight of her. When Joe Carr was interviewed by Channel 4 for the documentary The Killing Zone, he stated, quote, "It was either a really gross mistake or really brutal murder." The Israeli bulldozer operator was interviewed on Israeli television, and he insisted that he had no idea she was in front of him, saying, quote, "You can't hear. You can't see well. You can go over something and you'll never know. I scooped up some earth. I couldn't see anything. I pushed the earth and I didn't see her at all. Maybe she was hiding in there." But here's my thing. You knew that there were activists there. You knew that there was the possibility of hitting a person, and knowing that you had a limited field of vision should have made you even more cautious about where you were going. The IDF even produced a video about Rachel's death to make the case for themselves, which shows footage taken from the inside of the cockpit of the D9, showing the obscured vision inside the bulldozer. And I don't know why they're pushing for this narrative so hard, because to me, that seems like gross negligence. That seems like a big ass mistake. Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig, filed a lawsuit against Israel and the IDF for killing or negligently causing the death of their daughter. The Haifa court dismissed their claims, stating that the operator had not intended to kill Rachel and due to the blind spot issue. But on top of that, They stated that Rachel had taken the risk of entering the closed-off area and chose to climb the pile of dirt, thus putting herself in a dangerous situation. Talk about victim blaming. The court concluded that she was, quote, accidentally killed in the framework of a war-related activity. Therefore, the state bears no responsibility for the damages inflicted on the plaintiffs resulting from a war-related action, as defined in the Civil Wrongs Ordinance. Jesus Christ. She was asking to be killed. What did she think was going to happen? Ugh, so gross. As such, the court found that Rachel's acts, along with the other protesters, were illegal. Joseph Carr stated that they knew there was a risk, but they also knew that nothing like that had ever happened in the 2 years that ISM had been working in Gaza. They knew that they were at risk, but they felt like they were doing these things responsibly and the way that they had been taught and trained to do them that had been shown to work. Yasser Arafat, the first president of the Palestinian Authority, sent his condolences to the Khoury family and gave, quote, the blessings of the Palestinian people to Rachel. He also promised to name a street after her in Gaza, as according to Rachel's mom, Cindy, Arafat told her that Rachel was, quote, your daughter, but she is also the daughter of the Palestinians. She is ours now, too. There were multiple attempts by U.S. representatives to open an investigation, but it never worked out. Since their daughter's death, Rachel's parents have spent their time promoting peace and raising awareness about the plight of Palestinians to continue their daughter's work. They set up the Rachel Khoury Foundation for Peace and Justice and launched numerous projects in memory of Rachel. They've also visited the region numerous times now and have visited Gaza twice. After the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war, Cindy and Craig referred to the situation as genocide against Palestinian people and have been trying to keep in touch with Palestinians on the ground. Rachel did end up getting a street named after her in Tehran, Iran. This was the first time since the 1979 revolution that an Iranian street has been named after a U.S. national. Before the revolution, at least three streets in Tehran were named after former U.S. presidents. Why? On the 12th anniversary of her death, a symbolic gravestone with Rachel's name was installed in the Tehran Cemetery to honor her by the commemoration of martyrs near the gravestones of 12 other symbolic graves. And to close up Rachel's story, I want to read parts of Rachel's final email, which was sent to her dad. Thanks for your email. I feel like sometimes I spend all my time propagandizing mom and assuming she'll pass stuff on to you so you get neglected. Don't worry about me too much. Right now, I know I am most concerned that we are not being effective. I still don't feel particularly at risk. Rafa has seemed calmer lately, maybe because the military is preoccupied with incursions in the north, still shooting and house demolitions. One death this week that I know of, but not any larger incursions. Still can't say how this will change if and when the war with Iraq comes. Thanks also for stepping up your anti-war work. I know it is not easy to do and probably much more difficult where you are than where I am. She then wrote that she was wondering what she would do after leaving Gaza, writing that she didn't want to move back to Olympia but had to clean out her stuff. She wrote, quote, now that I've crossed the ocean, I'm feeling a strong desire to try to stay across the ocean for some time, considering trying to get English teaching jobs. Would like to really buckle down and learn Arabic. She wrote about leaving Rafa with a viable plan to return. She wrote, I really don't want to live with a lot of guilt about this place, being able to come and go so easily and not going back. I think it is valuable to make commitments to places, so I would like to be able to plan on coming back here within a year or so. She finished the email, quote, let me know if you have any ideas about what I should do with the rest of my life. I love you very much. If you want, you can write to me as if I was on vacation at a camp on the big island of Hawaii learning to weave. One thing I do to make things easier here is to utterly retreat into fantasies that I am in a Hollywood movie or a sitcom starring Michael J. Fox, so feel free to make something up and I'll be happy to play along. Much love, Poppy. Rachel. While Rachel and Aaron Bushnell's stories are incredibly important and show us Americans an example of what it means to be a true-hearted activist, willing to put themselves out on the line if that means for the potential of a better future for all. But the media attention garnered from both of these cases have outshone the Palestinian activists and civilians who have lost their lives to the cause as well. George Rishmawi, director of the Palestinian Center for Reapproachment Between Peoples, said, While Palestinians get shot by Israeli soldiers, no one is interested anymore. But if some of these foreign volunteers get shot or even killed, then the international media will sit up and take notice. What does that say about our country's racism and Islamophobia? Quite a lot. Journalist Sandra Jordan wrote in The Observer that on the night of Rachel's death, 9 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip, among them a 4-year-old girl and a man aged 80. A total of 220 people had died in Rafah since the beginning of the Intifada, and Palestinians know that the death of one American received more attention than the killing of hundreds of Muslims. So while we should honor what Aaron and Rachel have done, let their stories also move you toward a better understanding of why we as a country seem to care so much less about Black and brown people both at home and abroad. It's just something for us all to think about. I just find that to be such an incredibly harrowing and inspiring story, and one that must be repeated, but I think there's also a lot that we can learn about the reaction of Rachel's death versus the response that thousands and thousands of Palestinian citizens have gotten from the genocide that is occurring right now. And it's very, very clear that a white American girl obviously can garner much more sympathy. But I also think that Rachel should be an inspiration to all of us in finding something that we truly believe in and feel passionate about, and finding causes that we truly care about as well, and letting that lead us into new possibilities. Obviously, this was incredibly dangerous, but I applaud her for doing what she did. And I hope that you all really enjoyed her story. All right, I'm not going to see you on Friday, unfortunately, but I will see you next Monday. With all of that being said, I encourage you to rage on. Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.